Господин товарищ, мистер президент, ваш режим кровавый уже много лет.
The opposition appears to have settled on at least one tactic to deal with the Kremlin's efforts to crack down on dissent. They're making fun of it. And aided by social media, they're doing so in very public ways. A popular hashtag on Twitter when the State Duma was debating a bill making slander and libel criminal offenses was Klevesi Paka Mozhna, or slander while you still can. This sparked a series of tweets like, United Russia is a party of honest and decent people. When the Duma passed the slander bill, anti-corruption blogger Alexei Navalny took that opportunity to further ridicule the authorities. He distributed leaflets over the internet on fake United Russia letterhead with an ironically worded message to the ruling party's voters. Recently, there have been cases of United Russia being slandered with the inaccurate slogan, "The Party of Swindlers and Thieves." Our party considers this tendency unacceptable, the fake leaflets read. It went on to warn that using the slogan was now illegal and suggested alternative monikers. The party of our children's future, the party of not bought off officials, or the party of the harmonious family. Likewise, when the Duma passed a bill requiring NGOs receiving funds from abroad to register as foreign agents, Igor Chestin, head of the Russian branch of the World Wildlife Foundation, said his organization planned to use that phrase, meant as a stigma, as a mark of quality. WWF Materials, he says, will soon carry the slogan, "We're not swindlers and thieves, we're foreign agents. You can trust us." In one of the most elaborate and carefully orchestrated cases of ridicule, a Yekaterinburg man reacted to strict new legislation regulating public demonstrations by complying with it, to the point of absurdity. Rostislav Zhuravlyov managed to secure official permission and a police escort for a solitary stroll through Yekaterinburg to look at the city's sights. And then he posted a video of the entire episode on LiveJournal and YouTube. "My friends, the law on demonstrations is working well. I'm impressed. I'm honestly impressed," he said as his baffled police escort looked on. There's no doubt that this has all been very amusing for journalists, bloggers, and for the opposition themselves. But does the new political humor have any political impact at all? Hello, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name's Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me is my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin, managing editor of RFERL's Russian service. Welcome, Kirill.
Hello.
Later in the podcast, we'll be joined by a special guest, Sean Guillory, a historian and postdoctoral fellow at the University of Pittsburgh's Center for Russian and East European Studies and author of the eponymous blog, Sean's Russia Blog. Kirill, political humor, of course, is nothing new in Russia. You grew up hearing the anecdote of the Brezhnev period. But today, thanks to the internet and thanks to social media, what once made people giggle around kitchen tables can now go viral on the web and spread around the world in a matter of hours. I'd like to get the ball rolling with two questions. First, we spoke off mic yesterday a bit about how the tone of today's humor is very different from the Brezhnev-era anecdote, and I'd like you to share those insights with our listeners. And second, what, if any, does this political humor, what political impact does this political humor have at all, if any at all?
First consideration, the key word for all this subject is high-tech and internet. High-tech jokes, internet jokes, social networking, viral jokes and videos and so on. Hashtags, sure. Right. Photoshop pictures posted on the blogs and so on. All these things, they change the tone and the content of Russian political humor. Medium is a message. Mm-hmm. So new political humor is not so patriarchal and old-fashioned as it was in Soviet times. The latter was so-called kitchen humor and looked like something produced from inside, from the inside of the system. from the inside of the system.
From the inside of the system.
Yes,
the Soviet system.
Yeah. It's very serious, very important. You know this famous story when in the beginning of 70s some writer from Soviet Union came to Vladimir Nabokov in Switzerland and told him a lot of anecdotes about Brezhnev and the Soviet system and so on. Nabokov laughed a lot on them, but after that he said, all these great jokes, but they sound like those which servants tell about their masters. Now, the most part, or the big part of the political humor is positioned like the jokes of outside observers. This is the difference. This is the difference, first of all. This is not even just humor. This is irony, and which we can attribute to so-called creative class.
It's not pranks, too. It's not just humor. It's pranks.
We will return to this, but now I think it's time to highlight some sort of classification of contemporary political humor in Russia. Let's try to do this.
Let's try.
It's an enormous task, but we'll try. First, old style anecdote, like kitchen humor and so on. It still exists, and one of the good examples of this,
go for it.
Yeah. Putin goes to hell and meets the devil. We have a tradition. All newcomers to hell must be dipped in boiling sulfur. What were you? The devil asked. President and Prime Minister, Putin said. Dip this one twice, the devil said to his assistants. The assistants dip Putin twice and then, following a pause, a third time. You said no more than two times, Putin said. No more than two times in a row, the devil answered. This is an old style joke.
This could have been told about Brezhnev if he just changed the circumstances a little bit.
Yes. Another part of this classification is I'll define it as a new coarseness. Kind of direct and humorous punch. Something between the satire and the insult. A great master of this is Navalny. His famous definition of United Russia, you know, as a
party of thieves and swindlers and thieves.
Speaking from the point of culturology or history of culture and so on, it's a part of a new sincerity movement in modern Russian literature and music. So you began our podcast with a song by Leningrad. About the water, lack of water, and so on. And Leningrad and such poets like Всеволод Емелин and so on, they are the part of this movement. Historically, this is the result of the, you know, tiredness from the postmodernist irony and so on. So, you know, it'll kind of new sincerity. And the third part, my favorite one, is these high-tech jokes.
The pranks.
Yes, the pranks.
Because they're not just us telling jokes, then the others don't. The authorities learn about these things very quickly because they have they like Navalny's leaflets, for example. They react to them,
and it's very important that this is a part of a new kind of subculture in Russia. It's a subculture of designers, of all this internet crowd, and so on, and I think speaking about how dangerous is, so your second question, the impact, how this, all this political humor, satire, is dangerous for the authorities. The most dangerous, I think, is are the second and the third part of this process, because old style kitchen jokes and anecdotes and so on, they're very good, you can laugh at them and so on, but it's the same.
Brezhnev survived for decades as these things are flying around.
it's like you know, all this satirist and stand-up comedians like Zhvanevsky and so on. They're great, they're very talented and so on, but this is an old Soviet style of opposing the regime, sitting at your kitchen and drinking vodka. I think the more interesting and the more, you know, dangerous, by the way, for the authorities is a new style. When you are just sitting by your computer on your own, drinking green tea.
Hopefully green tea, because it's good for you.
Yeah. Or coffee, okay. And thinking. Yes, because the best tool of this political struggle against the regime is to provoke people to think. Mm-hmm. When I listen to some kind of anecdotes and so on, you are not thinking; you're mm-hmm. laughing.
Right.
But the main aim of these pranks and so on, just to begin to think about the absurdity of what's going on now.
It also goes back to one of the principles they teach us in journalism. It's called show, don't tell, right?
Yes.
An anecdote is telling.
Yes.
But when you do what Navalny did with those leaflets, or what this gentleman in Yekaterinburg did with his absurd compliance with the demonstration law posted on YouTube, you're showing. You're showing how absurd things have gotten, and that does get people to think a little bit more than a funny anecdote, I guess.
Yes, and this is very modern. Yeah, you know, it's all these people from Putin and Medvedev to Chubais, they're all the time they're speaking about the modernization of
right.
Russia, about Skolkova. Do you remember about Skolkova?
I forgot. I remember something. Medvedev,
yes.
Who's that, by the way?
By the way. And the real modernization begins from the modernization of public consciousness, of public mind, of public opinion, and the attitude to life and to politics and to, you know, social sphere and so on. And I think that this kind of humor is a next step in this direction.
Now, let me play devil's advocate for a minute here. I mean, is this just the clever creative class talking to each other?
Yes.
Or are they able to expand the auditorium of people that are thinking? Because if they're just talking to each other, we say in English it's preaching to the converted.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, yes.
And you're preaching to the choir. And if they're getting to that, what Kirill Rogov said, that 40% of people that support Putin, but it's soft. Are they getting to that, or are they just talking to the, you know, the 20% or so that's really hardcore anti-Putin?
That's why I'm speaking about the crucial role of this new coarseness, for instance, Navalny himself, because he's between the old-style humor and this new-style pranks and so on, and he used tools from both of them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why he can extend the range of this satire and the jokes and so on to this 40%.
Right.
And it's not just a pure, you know, humor of computer people, computer crowd and so
right.
on. In some sense, he's very, you know, popular. He is very popular because mm-hmm. of his, you know, he's very talented man, and he has a very good attitude to the direct, you know, tools, not just mm-hmm. of political struggle, but using the language and so on. So he can, I think he can, with all his pranks and so on, he can just change the situation in this particular sphere. Navalny jokes instead of Mikhail Zhvanetsky jokes, for
right,
instance,
right.
you know. And this is very serious.
Well, he got quite an assist from the authorities with these fake United Russia leaflets because, as I wrote in the blog, you know, this week,
bloopers. Yeah?
If the authorities just ignored that, you know, me and you and, you know, maybe 1,000 other people would have giggled about this. But they started accusing him of illegal agitation. And, you know, I saw Navalny's face on the United Russia website. I never thought I'd see that in my life. And I was reminded by Anna Akhmatova's famous quote about Joseph Brodsky after he was sentenced.
Yeah.
She said, oh, what a biography they're creating for our little redhead. You'd think he hired them.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if United Russia's working for right now, because they really gave this story another day of oxygen when it would have just nobody would have paid attention.
I think this is another part of the problem. Because United Russia and the regime is absolutely disconnected with real life. And that is the source of such things, as you told about the official website and so on. They're launching their own official website just don't thinking about their audience.
Right.
They don't need to think about their audience because they are United Russia political party. That's all.
They've gotten kind of fat and lazy, if you want to put it in those terms.
And that is a new, you know, political style of Putin 3.0.
Right.
Just absolutely disconnected with all the society, all reality, and so on, connected into itself. In this case, it's very interesting how they misunderstand everything concerning their own, you know, gestures, their own measures, their own politics, and so on. They even can't understand what's going on when Navalny defined them as a party of thieves and
swindlers
and thieves, and so on. They think that he's just joking.
Right.
And that is not
and
a
he's,
joke.
He, what he's done is he has rebranded them.
Yes.
I mean, he has rebranded them. I mean, you've seen the statistics from the Levada Center. It's like 40% of, I think it's in the 40s now, agree with the phrase, United Russia is the party of swindlers and thieves.
Yes.
And in Russian, it sounds even more sinister. Zhuliki Varov, it sounds like even more sinister.
They think that they're sitting inside the ivory tower.
Mm-hmm.
And they're making political art for its sake.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not, first of all, it's not an art. Secondly, they live in the situation of political crisis. And thirdly, their political enemy is very, very, very serious and strong.
Yeah.
They forget all about these things. Mm-hmm.
Now, one more question before we move on to the second segment. I wanted to, where do you think groups like Grupa Vajna, the art collective, or Pussy Riot, for that matter, because they're doing something else. They're doing art and music, so to speak. But there's an element of humor. I mean, there is certainly an element of humor of putting a, you know, what is it, 60-meter phallus facing the FSB building in St. Petersburg. That's funny. Saying, you know, singing publicly that Putin wet his pants is kind of funny. But yet, where do they fit into all of this?
Vajna this art group and Pussy Riot, they are part of so-called contemporary art movement in Russia. I think, of course, they have a very serious influence on the Russian political scene and so on. But we have to think about them in a wider international, art context. Because they're the descendants of French situationists.
Mm.
Andy Warhol factory and all of these things. Sure, in Russian context, it looks absolutely strange and so on, and even dramatic. Today was the opening hearing on Pussy Riot, and the arrest of the girls had been extended for more 6 months.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
They will be in the prison 1 year before the beginning of the trial.
What a biography they're creating for these girls.
Sure, sure. And
to quote Akhmatova.
Yes. And contemporary art became a very serious tool in modern Russian politics. But by the way, let's remember the history of the process. Who brought contemporary art or modern art into political sphere in post-Soviet Russia? It was Marat Gelman during Putin's
presidency,
first electoral campaign.
That's right.
It was in 1999, during SPS, Союз правых сил electoral campaign, and then Putin's electoral
campaign.
Because Marat Gelman, he worked for Putin campaign and so on. So everything that had been created during the first and second Putin's term just turned against him.
which is a very ominous sign. So the short, yes. the short
it's kind
answer
of Macbeth.
It's kind of
so you consider it like a political joke. Eh?
So the short answer to my question at the beginning of the segment is: you do think this is having a political impact? It appears. In a few moments, we'll shift gears from this lighthearted discussion of jokes, humor, and pranks and shift to a more weighty and, dare I say, academic topic of what role, if any, ideology plays in today's Russia. Do the terms left and right have any meaning? We'll also bring a special guest into the discussion, Sean Guillory, a historian and postdoctoral fellow at the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies. I'd like to remind you that you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name's Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me is my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin, managing editor of RFERL's Russian service. I'd also like to remind you that you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at RFERL.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical. The far eastern region of Kamchatka experienced a curious flashback earlier this week. During restoration work under a statue of Vladimir Lenin on July 15th, workers discovered a time capsule buried there by Komsomol members exactly 33 years earlier. Improve yourself and the world in the name of communism, as Vladimir Ilyich Lenin taught us, as the Communist Party teaches us, read the message, intended to be opened in 2024. The time capsule, of course, was unearthed 12 years too soon, and while Russia still does have a communist party, it's no longer the ruling party, and some would argue it's not even really communist at all, and it certainly isn't the vanguard of Russia's ruling ideology. As Kirill has pointed out numerous times in this podcast, Russia not only doesn't have a communist ideology anymore, it doesn't appear to have any ideology at all. There's, of course, no state ideology, but no political party seems to be guided by any set of governing principles. Some parties are identified as left or right, but they often appear to be that in name only. Sean, I want to start with you since I know where Kirill stands on this. Do you agree that ideology plays little or no role in Russia today? And have the terms left and right lost all meaning there?
Well, first, thanks for having me on. I think we have to think first, we have to talk about what we mean by ideology, because it's such a kind of a loaded word. And I kind of look at it in two ways, and I think it'd be helpful for this discussion. The first way, I think, pertains to your question in the sense that ideology can be a set of principles by individuals, organizations, for how they perceive or confront the past, present, and future. And here you can think of it as in a strict political sense that is usually associated with the platform of a party. Now, as for your question of whether left and right have any meaning today, I don't think how we conceive of left or right in the West actually really applies to Russia very well. In the West, the political spectrum seems to be depend on where one stands vis-a-vis capitalism. Are you for or against it? What level of support do you give to it or opposition to it? And also you have issues of kind of social values if you're conservative or more socially liberal. In Russia, these seem to be all jumbled together, mm-hmm. right? Communists can be left economically but right socially. Nationalists seem to be a little bit left economically but right socially. The liberals are right economically and left socially. So these are kind of all jumbled. They're not very consistent in Russia. And there's examples in the West of this inconsistency too, but nonetheless. And ironically, it seems to me that Putin and United Russia are kind of the center, a right center in this political spectrum. I find this quite ironic. But really, the way ideology works and how parties use them, I don't really see them using them as any kind of actionable program, right? You don't see the Communist Party in the Duma trying to actuate their principles. In fact, it just seems that ideology kind of works as an identity and a way to kind of garner political constituencies.
Occasionally,
right?
You'll see something. If I can interrupt just for a second, I mean, just this past week, United Russia and A Just Russia went out in against Russia's joining the WTO, right?
Right.
And so occasionally you'll see something like this, but it seems pro forma sometimes.
Yeah, occasionally you will, but I don't really give too much to this. I mean, you don't really see the Communist Party, for example, really putting all of their force forward. I mean, they really do have – they're one of the few parties that actually have a political structure and a political machine throughout the country. But I don't see them really using their power to challenge the status quo. If anything, I think what defines Russia ideologically is that there seems to be a consensus around the free market. There may be different views on where the free market, how it should be regulated, to what extent it should it exist. But there seems to be a consensus that nobody's really saying we should get rid of it.
Kirill, what do you think? Because you seem to think that Russia's. And Sean, I meant to greet you when I introduced you to ask the questions. Kirill, you often say Russia's basically left in terms of. How does that? Would you disagree with Sean's assertion that Russia's basically free market oriented that way?
I think it's a kind of riddle. I partly agree, yeah, with Sean. There is a kind of consensus in Russia about consumerism, but not about market.
That's interesting. Yeah, that's an interesting way to put it. Yeah. Yes.
So I'll divide these two things. So they love to buy, to consume, but they don't like the idea of free market economy, especially in medicine, in education, in some other things, including army, police, and so on. And at all, it's I think 3/4 of Russian life, society, and economy. So there is no connection between these two ideas, the idea of consumerism and free market economy in Russian public opinion. Secondly, I agree with Sean about this, central position of United Russia political party and so on. But let's speak about the, ideological, up to you, foundation of this position. Usually, we have been told that ideologically, United Russia is a kind of conservative power or party. But what conservatism means in Russian context? Let's begin from the very beginning of this word. Conservatism is that is conserving something.
Tradition, usually.
Yes, but tradition, but conserve. You have to conserve, to conservate something, to keep something, yes, in some form or position and so on. What is this tradition in Russian history that they want to conserve, to
That's
save?
A good question.
Pre-Soviet, Soviet, post-Soviet, Orthodox, Bolshevik, Alexander the Third, Alexander the First, Peter the Great.
Seems like they picked a little elements from a salad bar and put them all on a plate taken the ones they like. Sean, go ahead.
That means pragmatism.
Yeah. This leads into, I think, the second way of thinking of ideology. And I think this second way is actually more, I think, vital and important to think about. And that is ideology is a broader systemic how a dominant power legitimates its rule. And here I think that this is – and I think Kirill, in his mentions of the lack of ideology in the past, I read it as this, in the sense that the ruling elite in Russia – have not put forward an ideology kind of like the Soviet system did, where you have an understanding of the past, the present, but also more importantly, a conception of where society is going. And here is in a way a dominant power does this, how it legitimates its rule in ideology is that it promotes beliefs and values congenial to it. So here, in terms of preserving tradition or conserving tradition, I think that you're right in suggesting that the ruling elite have not put forward a tradition, a kind of narrative of tradition to conserve. They seem to be picking parts, but they haven't really constructed a kind of general narrative of those traditions. A ruling elite puts forward ideas that are naturalized and universalized, so they're self-evident to people in the population. They don't need proof. They just kind of exist. They denigrate and exclude rival ideologies. To some extent, this is occurring. And also, they obscure reality in ways that are convenient to its power. So in the sense, it's about removing social conflict. And a successful elite in putting forward an ideology of legitimate its rule essentially convinces the population that their interests and the ruling elite's interests are equal. And that ruling elite is ruling in the interests of society at large. And I think that one good example of this is actually the American Dream. I think this is a very powerful ideology in the United States that essentially maintains the power structure. The Russian elite, the only thing they've seemed to put forward is, as Kirill says, consumerism, money. But there doesn't seem to be any social values that bind the population together to say we are moving in this direction together, that we will prosper together. Similar to how, you know, this kind of this time capsule that the Komsomol buried. I mean, to think that somebody would put a statement like that today anywhere in the world. Right. I think there's a general crisis of thinking beyond, say, capitalism or the system, beyond democracy, liberal democracy. There's a certain crisis of utopianism in general across the planet, and I think Russia is certainly part of this.
Now, I want to play devil's advocate here again a little bit, and that's that maybe it's not such a bad thing that there isn't any kind of ideological glue holding Russia together. When you think, I mean, Sean, you mentioned the American Dream, but beyond that, I really, if somebody asked me what's the ideology of America, I couldn't tell you. What is the ideology of Germany or France or Great Britain? Liberal states don't really need binding ideologies.
France isn't a liberal state.
Okay, all right, enough of that ideology.
It's etatism.
But what the left-right spectrum looks like in a liberal state, I mean, the left tends to favor more state intervention in the economy. The right tends to favor less state intervention in the economy. In the American case, the left favors more state intervention, less state intervention, I'm sorry, in the so-called cultural sphere. The right favors more state intervention in the cultural sphere. You tend to get a spectrum, but you don't have this binding ideology. And I guess what I wanted to, where I'm going with this is that maybe it's not such a bad thing that Russia doesn't have any kind of ideology now, because that's going to allow eventually for this to naturally take hold in society where it should take hold.
I don't object to this idea. Of course, a lack of ideology is not such a bad thing. I'm not a great supporter of the ideology. I spent first 27 years of my life in Soviet Union, so it's okay. If you have some kind of social values instead of ideology, everything is perfect. But we already told sometime during our podcasts about the kind of atomization of post-Soviet Russian society. That is very dangerous. So they can't establish a horizontal links between people, between groups, and so on. This phenomena I call atomization.
And nihilism. You speak of nihilism.
And nihilism. Also about nihilism. So I'm not speaking that the lack of ideology is very bad for Russia. We are just analyzing the situation, and we see that, first of all, the lack of ideology, and I am sure that this is very serious, because I consider the ideology as a, you know, first of all, as a system of the ideas, and secondly, as a system of the ideas with a very clear image of a future.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's why I love the beginning of this part of our podcast when you mentioned this uncovering of the buried Komsomol capsule about our future and about future of communism and so on. Of course, all of this is Komsomol rubbish and, you know, and all this music of Soviet prog rock. Весна Комсомол and so on, Lenin. But speaking seriously, Soviet ideology was real ideology, even in late Brezhnev times, because it has a very clear image of a future. Now we have not an ideology in Russia. We have a, I'll define it like sporadic, random ideological gestures made in pragmatic aims.
You wrote that down, this... didn't you?
I would agree with this. I mean, but I think we have to think about ideology, and this is my second model that I put forward. It's not about politics. It's about values. It's about the fact that the Soviet system, for example, created Soviet people with certain values, with certain understandings of what it means to be cultured, what it means to be a Soviet person, what it means to work for the future. And this, I think, this ethical aspect of ideology did bind the country for the most part. And in Russia, I think you're right in the sense that, for me, ideology exists not actually – it's not produced and reproduced at the level of say, the government or the Kremlin or even the White House. It's produced in technologies and institutions of consent, the educative system, the media, and these areas that reaffirm the dominant ideology of the society. And here, Brian, I would disagree with the fact that you have a trouble to identify ideology in liberal states only attests to the fact of how successful that ideology is.
That's a good point taken. Okay.
That it's so naturalized that it's difficult to even identify. Now, you can say, yes, there's differences of, you know, people on the left have this things about the market in the state and people on the right have this about the market in the state. But nobody is questioning the fundamental correctness and naturalness of the market. And I think that if anything, this is for a liberal society, this is the fundamental ideology: individualism, liberal democracy, et cetera, et cetera. Nobody questions these fundamentals. In Russia, I don't think – I mean, this goes to my idea that the ruling elite in Russia has domination but not hegemony. They have not created the consensual apparatus within the society. And this is evident in my thinking by the fact that earlier in the podcast you said, why don't they just ignore these jokes?
Right.
They don't ignore these jokes because they know that, or they have a sense that their power and control is tenuous. They're insecure of their own power. This is how I see it from their perspective. They're, in a sense, know that the whole thing could collapse if something goes the wrong way. And this, to me, suggests that they have not created that consensual apparatus.
Kirill?
Oh, I totally agree with Sean in this case. And moreover, I think that this problem of the values is crucial for not just for Russia, but for all modern world, including the West. Historically, we can see this process as, you know, Protestantism crystallized as a liberal values, liberalism as an ideology crystallized as a modern liberal values in modern Western world. So this is a very long process, and Russia doesn't have this process in its history. And Russia now is in the process of inventing somehow its own values, not national, not religious, not you know, political, but something special, something between all these points, and because values are usually between these points of politics, economy, and so on. It's something, you know, in disguise,
right.
And this is a very painful process. Because a lot of population still have still has Soviet values, which are not so bad, which are not basically so bad, because it's based on the idea of equality, of you know, everything. Yeah, and it's very interesting and very sometimes very funny how these Soviet values coincide with or mixed with consumerism.
Right. So well, that's where it gets interesting.
Yes, it's very funny, really. Returning to the jokes, it's very funny because at the same time, someone, you know, is Krasnoyarsk can be a fervent communist And at the same time, a part of the audience of soap operas on TV.
Avid consumer.
And consumer, yeah. And so on. That is very interesting. But this is just the beginning of the process. In the West, you have these liberal values and all this history, long history from the Reformation.
Right.
Of the foundation of these values and so on. In China, they have Confucian values and so on. In Japan, they have their own traditional and not so traditional values and so on. But not in Russia, because everything is destroyed.
What about the old messianic Russian idea that Berdyaev writes?
Forget about this. just Surkov rubbish. Part of Surkov propaganda.
No, it predates Surkov.
Before Surkov, it was very serious. Yes, of course, but not now, because no one seriously can consider this idea about messianic what.
Mm-hmm.
Where? Right. In Central Asia, in Caucasus, right. In Poland.
Right.
Where?
And this goes to the general problem of trying to imagine, well, what are we in a mission for?
Right.
Right. I really do think there is a global crisis of what is beyond the state that we are in now. How do we move toward a kind of collective future, even based on a national level? And I think this is a general crisis. And I think that Russia – I don't necessarily agree with Kirill in the sense that there seems to be these great breaks in Russian history, that the old has been destroyed and now they're trying to figure out the new. I think what I find interesting about Putin is the attempt to try to reconcile – all of these ruptures in Russian history. So the revolution 1917, the collapse of communism in 1991, into a general narrative of Russian history, to not see, say, the Soviet period as this kind of derailment of kind of march toward whatever. They're trying to reincorporate it into a long Russian history with its own particular trajectory. And I think that is an attempt to maybe tap into some of those deep structural cultural values within Russia. Now what those are, now that's a different question.
I want to bring us back, as we're coming to the rapidly approaching the finish line, as I see the clock. I want to bring us back to the jokes, actually, and some of the things Kirill said about that this power horizontal is something I've called it, but there is something happening horizontally in Russia right now, at least among the creative class. And it's happening across the country. It's not just a Moscow phenomenon. It's not just St. Petersburg phenomenon. With these jokes, with these viral videos, with the opposition, with everything that's happening on social media, is a kind of new society emerging across this horizontal? It's not being connected. You said the state doesn't have the glue to connect this horizontal together anymore, but this horizontal seems to be connecting itself together. Is there something happening there? And number two, are there common values being developed across this horizontal, or is it atomized even as it's integrating, so to speak, if that makes any sense whatsoever?
My answer will be yes on the first question and no on the second question.
Okay.
Because we are in the beginning of the process of the construction of these horizontal links or connections or network or whatever. And the same thing was, it's very interesting, in the 1970s during the Soviet times, when Brezhnev launched his program of municipal housing.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of people got their own private flats and so on. It was, as I usually put it, it was the beginning of the process of the privatization of their own lives.
Uh-huh.
It was absolutely different from the Stalin or Khrushchev times, because when people they have their own flat with their own kitchen, where you can drink vodka and tell anecdotes. Uh-huh. And so on. This is the beginning.
It's the first social network.
Yes, yes. And that is the beginning of the first real horizontal network in the Soviet Union. Because a lot of very informal groups emerged from the process, not just dissident or political or cultural and so on, just the collectors of post stamps or whatever. A lot of them, a lot of magazines who had been printed or was printed for these people, Technika Молодежи especially, Наука и Жизнь, a lot of them. So everything was collapsed in the 1980s with all these new hardships and then the collapse of Perestroika and then so on. Now I see the same process, but it is technologically it's absolutely different because
it's faster
and so on. That's why I'm answering yes.
So the horizontal is gluing itself together.
Yes,
but
there is no any ideas or values which are common for even for some of them. Because a creative class usually is based on their belief in market economy and so on, but this belief is a little bit all outdated, old-fashioned. Mm-hmm. So they read Ayn Rand or something like Hayek or whatever. Or like one of the most popular Russian journalist and columnist, Yulia Latynina.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very good example of such state of mind.
Right. Mm-hmm. I know where you're going. Go ahead.
Yeah. but other people, especially in Russian province and so on, they're just left. And now we see the who are just in the middle of public or political conflict or crisis now. Pussy Riot feminists or, Vajna leftist group. Yes, and so on. So there is no any, they disagree in everything.
Well, Pussy Riot and Vajna are together.
Yeah, they're
by marriage. They're linked.
not just together. They. So it's a special story. Yeah. Yes, but the answer no.
Okay.
They don't have any common values.
So it's a power. It's a horizontal of nihilists. A horizontal atomized horizontal of nihilists.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I mostly agree with that analysis, and I would just add that the problem with this kind of civil society, if you want to just label it that, there is a horizontal action going on, but it's reactive. It's not proactive in the sense that it's only reacting to Putin. It's not creating something or thinking about something beyond the Putin system or even the political situation Russia is in now. And I think that is, and Kirill, you brought this up a few podcasts ago, a fact that it's just a strength and a weakness. The fact that they can bind together based on their opposition to Putin, but the fact that they're obsessed with him is a weakness because it prevents them from setting their own – they can't speak about their own ideological differences for fear that would break them all up. And I think that if the opposition has any chance of going forward, it's going to have to put forward some kind of vision, however loose, but some kind of real vision – that would appeal to the population.
Right. And as we've talked about this in past podcasts, it's almost impossible for them to do that given the ideological diversity of the opposition, which ranges everywhere from Western liberals to nationalists to communists. Well, this is one of these subjects we're never going to get to the bottom of, I fear, and people centuries from now will be probably having the same conversation. That's all we have time for, unfortunately, today. I'd like to remind you that you've been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me in Prague has been my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin, managing editor of RFERL's Russian service. And on the line from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, has been Sean Guillory, a historian and postdoctoral fellow at the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies. Thanks for the great discussion, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I'd also like to thank our excellent producer, Tanya Kancheva, whom I will not embarrass this week with a silly comment. I'd also like to remind you that you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog on rferl.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week, and for now, I'll leave you again with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.